We talk about a lot of serious books on this show. In fact, we've got a great one coming up in a bit. And we know you like that sort of thing. But, my dear NPR listener, I have to tell you that the most profitable part of the publishing world, by far, is romance. Romance novels are a $1.4 billion industry. Literary titles, just $400 million. Jesse Barron is a writer at Harper's Magazine, and last summer, he went to the RNC. That's the Romance Novel Convention in Las Vegas. The master of ceremonies wasn't a writer. It was a cover model.
A very handsome guy, looks sort of like Patrick Dempsey, but a little more soap opera. And he welcomed maybe 300 women with a few husbands, but mostly married white women in middle age in a huge ballroom in the Golden Nugget in Las Vegas. The initial kickoff was really surprisingly sexy and explicit. There was a cover model who did a pretty heavy striptease to Wanted Dead or Alive by Bon Jovi, and that sort of set the tone.
So the character who's running this thing, this organizer, Jimmy Thomas,
yes.
He's a cover model for these romance novels, right? So the only other one I've heard of before that would be Fabio.
Yeah, he is like Fabio, and I think he experiences a professional rivalry, or at least he experiences that. Fabio obviously is not experiencing it, but he's in that lineage of men who make money off this completely, otherwise almost completely female-dominated genre. I mean, romance is published, written, edited, bought by women. 90 to 95% of romance readers are women. The one exception in the industry is male cover models. These are guys who sell stock photos to writers directly or sometimes to editors to put on the covers of these ebooks. And the stock photos sell from anywhere from maybe $15 to $300.
So did Jimmy have any tips for what makes a good cover, what'll sell books?
Yes, he does. For all of the aspiring romance writers out there, the biggest thing that you should do is go look at the number one most commercial, most successful romance and copy that exactly. He's figured out what does best. So, for example, a cover where a man is dipping a woman down and kissing her will do slightly less well than a cover where a woman is being dipped down and the man is about to kiss her neck. And there's all of these types of sort of oddly specific arrangements that Jimmy has figured out. And the end goal, of course, is something that will catch the eye of someone browsing on the Amazon store or Kobo or the Sony bookstore.
How big a slice of the romance market now are ebooks?
It's estimated that about 60% of all romance novels are ebooks, and that's compared with about 40% of trade fiction. I think one thing is that literary fiction does not get along well with ebooks and self-publishing because it takes too long to write, and ebooks are cheap. So ebooks will favor writers who can write schematically, quickly. It's low overhead, it's high quantity, and the cover price is $2, $3, $4, $5, $6. So a writer who knows that they're dealing with 24 chapters and turning points and so on, and then they're going to get to a happily ever after ending or a happily for now, an HFN if they're writing serially, that writer who can produce two or three books a year is going to do really, really well in an economy where the cover prices are low and they get a huge amount of the cover price returned, which is the ebook model. So that model is fantastic for romance. Detective fiction also does well in ebooks. But the literary production world that's based in New York, I think, will never be able to exploit ebooks the way genre fiction does, and it's because those writers know what they're doing every time.
You obviously picked up on some things while you were there, sprinkled into this article. Are there any other tips you can share with us?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that you have to understand if you're going to get into writing romance is that the things that are valued in that genre are not the same things that are valued when we read something like literary fiction. So you're going to want to hone your prose until it's extremely clear. It's very, very fast. The dialogue is funny and the plots are really engaging. But you also have to keep in mind that you don't have total freedom when it comes to your main character, and that's your heroine. She's got to be tough, but she can't be cold. She can't be whiny. She can't be a b***h. And if she's got those walls up, you must show her vulnerability. She is just like the reader. And once you wrap your mind around that, you'll start writing characters that people will recognize as romance heroes and heroines. And then you have to think about what is going to happen in your book and what the plot is. And it's really important to remember, again, that there's not infinite options. A typical romance will begin when the heroine decides that she wants the hero. they're not narratives where the hero is cheating around and having a bunch of different women and then ultimately deciding on his person. Heroes and heroines in romances never, ever cheat. So you don't have the option of these kinds of, like a novel based around dating or something like that could never be transposed into romance. It's really about the relationship between two people and the way that they gradually become more vulnerable to each other over time.
That's Jesse Barron. His article, Bad Romance, is in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Trevor Cox delights in sounds that he has discovered. He's a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford in England, and now he's written a book based on what he has found. The book is called The Sound Book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. He's gone to creaking glaciers, humming dunes, and a Mayan pyramid that chirps like a bird. In his book, Cox explores natural environments with surprising acoustical characteristics and also man-made environments, for example, accidental whispering galleries.
In Britain, probably the most famous whispering galleries is in St. Paul's Cathedral. You can go up into the base of the dome and you whisper into one side of the dome and the sound skims around the inside and your friend can hear it on the other side, you know, 30, 35 meters away, and it sounds like its whispers are emerging from the wall remarkably loud.
But it wasn't built that way. No one said, let's have a whisper gallery.
No, it's just pure accident. You can get it out of lots of curved surfaces. There's a dam in Australia, which acts like a whispering wall. Well, they didn't build a dam in Australia to give you this acoustic effect, but it's a tourist attraction. They've obviously built it to hold back water.
You provided us with the sound of, actually, it's a balloon bursting in the whispering gallery. I gather balloons bursting are, it's a stock in trade for you.
I do seem to be spending a lot of time bursting balloons. This is not the one in St. Paul's Cathedral, because, funnily enough, the attendants wouldn't allow you to burst a balloon. But this is actually up in a radar dome in Germany, Cold War Listening Station, which has this perfectly spherical dome at the top, which has this most amazing effect, because in a normal whispering gallery, you whisper and the sound just goes around the dome once. When you make a big sound, it goes around many times. You can hear it doing many circuits of the whispering gallery.
You do write about one example where people made interesting use of the acoustic accident of architecture. There's a church where the whisper function was used for priests taking the confession of lepers.
I'm not sure how true it is, but it certainly is told lots. If you go and visit Clonmacnoise in Ireland, you'll certainly get told the story. It's a sort of ornate sort of Gothic archway with a nice round sort of pipework, you know, coming round the top of the arch. And the idea is the priest would stand in one side of the doorway and the leper would stand in the other, and they'd whisper into this tunnel effectively. And the sound would whiz round, and that would mean the priest wouldn't have to get too near the leper when taking confession.
It's such a good story. I'm inclined to have you tell it on the air, even if it isn't true. It's so good.
I just thought, being a scientist, I ought to just put the skeptical point.
It's very good. One of the sonic wonders of the world that you sought out for this book was the place with the, I guess it's the longest reverberation in the world. And I want you to tell us about what you think, at least, would qualify as the most reverberating site on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, Guinness has acknowledged it's the most, well, they call it the longest echo. There was a bit of an argument about terminology because it's actually reverberation, but it's Guinness's record. They can call it what they like, I guess. And I was told about this place. It was an old oil storage depot. This is up in Scotland, and it was supplied the Navy with shipping oil. They're the size of a small cathedral on the inside, but they're really smooth walls. So we went to measure it. We fired a starting pistol, which is a normal measurement way of doing it. And the sound, the recordings last about 60, 70 seconds.
I don't think we have enough time to wait for this sound to stop reverberating.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's quite amazing, stood there, because I was watching the time on the digital recorder ticking up, and I just could not believe how long it was.
At the opposite extreme of the sounds that you sample for the book is being inside an anechoic chamber, unlike the other places that you report on, is actually built not to have an echo.
You know, when you're doing acoustic engineering, at some point you've got to measure, let's say, a loudspeaker or a microphone. You don't want the effect of rooms or whatever, a noise. So you go into an isolated room where there's no effect acoustically of a room, and that's what an anechoic chamber provides. So big acoustic labs have them.
Well, we heard the sound of a balloon bursting inside that amazingly reverberant tank in Inchendown. Here's the sound you recorded of a balloon bursting inside the anechoic chamber. Boy, was that a letdown.
But actually, it kind of isn't. I think it's sort of underwhelmingly magnificent, really, because you expect to hear a bang like you would at a kid's party when the balloon bursts, and it goes foot. It doesn't really do very much.
Do you have a favourite noise of all the ones that you recorded for the soundbook?
I guess the one which gave me the biggest smile was probably the musical Road in California, which plays the William Tell overture rather badly as you drive over it. That gave me quite a laugh.
You have to explain how that is, that you hear the William Tell overture.
Well, when you drive down the highway, often there's rumble strips down the side which stop you driving. You know, if you were to veer off the highway, you'd make a buzzing sound. Well, a musical road takes a step further by changing the spacing of the corrugations so that you get a tune out of it. So sometimes the corrugations are close together, you get a high frequency. Sometimes they're far apart, you get a low frequency. And the musical road in Lancaster in California is all these ridges, well, actually grooves are spaced out on the second lane, and it actually will play the entire first phrase from the theme from the Lone Ranger. They got the spacing of the rumble strip wrong. It's got, you know, it would be amusing if it wasn't tragic. So it should be, the last note should go up to an octave above the first note, but it doesn't. It goes up, for those with musical, it goes up about a fifth. So it could sound a lot better.
Trevor Cox, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Trevor Cox's book is called The Sound Book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. Economist Paul Oyer devotes a chapter of his new book to the principle behind niche dating sites, the kind that Elise was just talking about. Oyer is a professor at Stanford Business School, and his book is called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics I Learned from Online Dating. And Paul Oyer, we should clarify at the outset that you were teaching economics long before your own adventures in online dating, yes?
That is true.
But the experience that you and millions of others have had, you say, illustrates principles that you teach in economics.
Yeah, it does. And it does it in a nice context, because I think a lot of people think about economics and they think about money. And I really like teaching economics through online dating because it's a context where no money changes hands, and yet so many of the ideas we as economists study are playing out.
You do acknowledge that in some cases money may change hands, but you're not going to address those instances of online services.
There is a footnote acknowledging that there are certain types of transactions I don't get into where money does indeed change hands.
Well, the subject that Elisa was reporting on is one that you address in a chapter called Thick versus Thin Markets. What do thick and thin mean in this case?
Well, a thick market is one with a lot of participants. And so you want your stock markets to be thick, because then it'll be easier to trade. There'll be more supply and demand, and we'll have a more efficient market where transactions will be easier and nobody will feel they're getting ripped off. Now, in the online dating world, and the job market is exactly the same, mm-hmm. We want a thick market because we want better matches. And I want to go to one that has a lot of alternatives because I want people who are closer to what I'm looking for.
But what about a very thin market, I guess, which would be people in search of relationships with economicsprofessors.com?
Well, that's a niche site I'd like to see try to get going, mm-hmm. for my own personal reasons, but I wouldn't invest money in that. And so these niche sites can be very useful if the niche is big enough. So the site you just laid out and other ones, like there's a gluten-free site and there's a tennis site that I tried, I think those niches are just too small. The niche sites that have done very well are the ones where the niche is big enough to create a thick market. So Christian Mingles has been very successful, for example.
Now, in your chapter on thick and thin markets, you managed to go from online dating services to work on how hospitals hire gastroenterologists. I want you to explain the connection there.
Well, so the gastroenterologist market every year is exactly like the dating market. At the end of a fellowship, a gastroenterologist will go looking for a job, and there are hospitals out there that are looking for gastroenterologists. So it's a job market that is very much like an online dating site in some ways. Now, it's a very thin market. There are just a few hundred, I forget the exact number, gastroenterologists who become available every year. In some years, when supply of gastroenterologists is particularly low, the market breaks down. It's just too thin, and somebody has to come in and fix the market from outside rather than let supply and demand naturally do it by itself.
Now, at the end of each chapter in your book, which I should note is one of the thinner economics books one can read, is a very great attraction, you offer a few summary lessons. And after the chapter on thick and thin markets, you write that big markets allow for more customization. You acknowledge the great benefits of big markets. But in the epilogue of the book, you describe what I gather is your own happy relationship with a woman you met in a thin market. Do I have that right?
Well, I met her on J-Date, and I think my story is actually the exact illustration of why thick markets are so important. My girlfriend works 100 yards away from me, and we actually had many friends in common. But we met on J-Date, and the reason, even though we had friends in common, we hadn't met, but we both went to where the market for the type of person we were looking for was thick, which is an online dating site. And it turns out that was a great way to meet, even though we were running across each other in this thin market, but not noticing each other all the time.
The market became thick because it was limited to only people who were looking to have a relationship with somebody
else. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So I run across people like my girlfriend all the time, but very few of them are looking for a relationship. And so what made the market thick was we both went to this online dating site where everybody was there for that one reason.
The relationship is still fine?
It's going great, despite the fact that she keeps hearing me talk about online dating in this incredibly rational manner.
Well, good luck with that one. And thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's Professor Paul Oyer, whose book is called Everything I Ever Needed to Know About Economics, I Learned from Online Dating.
Traveling can take on many modes: air, bus, boat, car. But how about traveling a few thousand miles on a bicycle? On this week's travel segment, Winging It, we hear from Nick Hand. He's an English designer and photographer who recently set off on his bicycle from Brooklyn, New York, and he traveled north up the Hudson River, where he collected stories of local artisans he happened to meet along the way. He's put all those stories together in a new book called Conversations on the Hudson. Nick Hand joins us from the BBC studios in Bristol. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
What inspired you to do this journey?
I did a similar journey around the coast of Britain a few years ago, and I started collecting stories from artisans, people that generally kind of worked with their hands, spinners, wood turners, potters, and I just found them like really inspirational people. And I guess the other thing is, when you're cycling sort of long distances on a really heavy bike, those kind of inspirations just keep you going. And because I cycle on my own, these people became my kind of best friends for the day. And So I kind of set out to look out for them, and then I came over to New York. My wife was working in New York City, so I planned this journey heading north.
So let's talk about some of the characters that you met along the Hudson River. One of them, whose story you tell, is a man named Ted. He's a stone carver. Tell us about him and his work.
I just cycled through a bit of forestry. I think it was Nyack State Park. And the first thing that you see are lots of stone-carved faces looking out at you, which is, I guess, quite an unusual thing to come across. So I kind of hung around, and Ted just happened to turn up in his battered old red car, and we just got chatting.
You recorded some of your conversation with him. Let's listen.
Most of them, they have a face since they're hiding. So I figure maybe I expose the face, I achieve certain amount of success.
He was just a great artisan, and the little clip you heard of how he thinks there's a sort of face in every stone and he's just releasing the face sounds a bit kind of weird, but it's kind of a beautiful thing to say as well. Yeah, he said some funny things. Like he said, everyone sees a face that's a bit like theirs, and he asked me to pick out the one that I thought looked like me, so you pick out a good-looking face. And he said, no, you look like that one over there, and it's kind of a real long face with big long nose, which is probably a bit more accurate, to be fair.
You met another person, Woody Guthrie's granddaughter. Are you a Woody Guthrie fan?
I am a big Woody Guthrie fan, yeah.
That must have been pretty cool.
It was really cool, yeah. And I'd been to the 100th anniversary of Woody's birth, and there was a concert. And the first person that came on at the concert was Anna Canoni, who is Woody's granddaughter. And she read this just beautiful poem. And when I met her, I asked her if she would read the poem again.
And you recorded that second reading. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of that.
I hate a song that makes you think you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think that you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're too old or too young, or too fat or too slim, too ugly or too this or too that.
You meet all kinds of people on the road. You also meet a sheep farmer, a maple syrup producer, a boat restorer. But I'd like to ask you about the seed librarian, which is a concept I hadn't really thought of before. Explain what that means.
Well, he called himself a small town librarian, so a book librarian. And he was also a very keen gardener. He had come across this sort of issue of finding seeds which were kind of hardy enough for where he lived, which is quite a harsh climate. So he started collecting hardy local seeds, and he had this idea of putting them into the library system so people could check out seeds in the spring, and then come the fall they would return the seeds, much like you would a book, but over the kind of 6 month growing period. And he developed this and eventually left the library, and he set up the Hudson Valley Seed Library.
What do you ride? Do you have a specific bike that you take on these trips?
Yeah, well, it's an English touring bike. It's made in my home city in Bristol. So it's handmade. It's a bit like having a suit made for you, and it kind of fits you exactly and super comfortable. And when you're on it, you just feel like that's where you belong.
So where next for you?
Well, I've set up a letterpress community business in Bristol, and I've got plans to have a courier bike built that I can put a little printing press on the back. I'm thinking of cycling to Mainz in Germany, which is where Gutenberg, who invented printing removable type, and so I've got this kind of plan to maybe do this journey with a little printing press and print postcards and send them back to people on the way. Sounds a bit crazy, but
romantic.
Maybe. Some might say romantic. Some might say crazy. But
arduous.
Okay.
Nick Hand, he spoke to us from the BBC studios in Bristol. Nick, thanks so much for talking with us, and safe travels.
Bye-bye.
We would love to hear about some of the more interesting places you have been on a bicycle. You can leave your tales of adventure on our Facebook page. You are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Every war has its unsung heroes. With all the American lives lost in Iraq, we often overlook the contributions of ordinary Iraqis who helped the U.S. military, often at great personal risk. I sat down with one former Iraqi interpreter now living in the U.S. He actually accompanied Navy SEAL teams on raids to capture suspected insurgents. Because of that sensitive work, he identifies himself by his code name.
My name is Johnny Walker, and I live in California. I work with SEALs now as a culture advisor.
Even today, living in America, Johnny still goes by his code name. He needs to protect his extended family, still living in Iraq, from retribution. But all of that, the war, the fear, and the American pseudonym, Johnny never could have imagined any of it growing up as a tall, athletic kid in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul.
So my background, I play basketball and high jump. And
I should mention you're quite tall for people at home.
And of course, you know, basketball, you have to love Harlem team. You love Harlem team, that means you have to listen to American country music. You have to watch American Hollywood movies.
American popular culture was cool when Johnny was growing up in Mosul. A lot of that good sentiment was there when U.S. forces arrived in 2003. Young Iraqis like Johnny flocked to work for them.
I mean, everyone loved to work with Americans because it's good money. It's kind of, you will be so proud. Oh, guys, I work with Americans, you know? This is at the beginning.
Johnny really wanted a job as an interpreter. He was newly married and starting a family. For weeks, he went from military base to military base, asking for work. Finally, he got lucky.
I still remember I met one of the guys, and I told him, do you think I have a chance to work with you? And he says, indeed. And I couldn't figure out what indeed mean. Until, like, after a few days, I asked one of the guys, and he says, it means sure.
Johnny was elated. He quickly distinguished himself as a reliable and fearless translator. Luis Lastra was one of the SEALs who went out on missions with Johnny.
The best part about having Johnny along was knowing the people, knowing the culture. A lot of the interpreters were great when we were teaching the Iraqi troops. But when we actually would go outside the wire on operations, Johnny had a little bit, I guess he didn't have the fear factor quite that some of the other ones had. And we knew that even physically, he could hang with us.
Wait a second, because that's worth repeating. Johnny could physically hang with the Navy SEALs, the most elite of special ops warriors. Missions could last for many hours and require quick, precise movement. They faced ambushes and snipers, and they often operated under the cover of darkness. It was extremely dangerous, and as a civilian interpreter, Johnny was not allowed to carry a gun.
I have my buddies, and SEALs, they have famous saying, no one left behind. And why do you need piece of metal to carry it if you have all the teams covered in your back, you know?
But the SEALs weren't with Johnny 24 hours a day, and as the war dragged on, Iraqis working with Americans became targets. Someone mailed Johnny's family a letter with a bullet in it. Johnny bought an AK-47 for protection. One day, he was driving alone when he noticed a car behind him.
There is two guys. They start following me, and it looks like they are not good guys, so I have to do something. So I took right, I pushed the gas hard, and they tried to pass me. I stopped suddenly, and I still remember the pistol, 9mm, and they shot and hit the middle of the car, you know. And I took my AK, and I shoot both of them, and I kill them.
You had an AK-47 with you?
Yeah, with me. And this is legal. I mean, if it's not legal, it's my life, too. I have to do it, you know?
But the danger was not over. A crowd gathered around the cars. People wanted to know what had happened. It was a tense situation. So Johnny lied. He said he had killed the men because they worked for the Americans. It worked. Satisfied with that answer, the crowd dispersed.
There's no rules. When somebody want to kill you, there's no rules.
Johnny did his best to protect his family, but by 2006, it became clear that staying in Iraq was not an option.
My family traveling every day from place to place, and it's not about me. It's about my family and my kids. They should have, like, fair life with a dream and a future, you know? So I decided to leave.
Johnny applied for a U.S. visa under a special program for people just like him and his family who faced a clear threat in Iraq because of their affiliation with Americans. But even though Johnny's visa application had the support of military leaders, it took years before he and his family were finally granted residency in the U.S.
We land in Chicago, and I took my son, and I still remember, like, I turn around left and right. If somebody is going to shot me or shot my son, and this looked like, Johnny, wake up. This is America. Done. No more nightmare, you know? It's a huge feeling.
Today, Johnny and his family live in California, and they're settling in nicely, thanks to a lot of support from his old SEAL friends. You can read more about his experience working with American SEAL teams in his new book, Codename Johnny Walker.